pork. Or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Fariza, London.
Well, Dr. Bob Gill, who's the producer of the great NHS Heist, and of course, a practicing family GP. Now, why has the take-up been so low, Dr. Gill? I mean, we've heard some of the reasons here, but how are you finding it from your perspective?
Well, generally, my patients are very well. The vaccine, if we hear there's any hesitation amongst high-risk groups, then we can take the time to speak to individual patients and reassure them that the vaccine is safe. All my staff who are eligible have had the vaccine. I have had the vaccine, my wife's had the vaccine, and often when they have these personal accounts and reassurance from a trusted health professional, that often helps get over the hesitation.
Now, one of the major issues here is the misinformation being promoted online. How can that be combated?
It's very difficult. You know, it doesn't take long for lies to spread very widely, and often there may even be an element grain of truth, but things get amplified out of all proportion, and they pick up on individuals' mistrust of government, as your report very clearly outlined. And you know, we do know society is not equal. There is discrimination out there in society, particularly, you know, with the hostile environment and how poor immigrant populations have been treated in recent years. So that trust has been eroded by government policy. But when it comes to healthcare, in particular, the uptake in the vaccination program, we have to undo some of that damage, which has been, you know, well-founded in terms of trust in government.
Now, we're hearing several reports that there are different European countries that are seriously considering implementing the vaccine passports for those who are thinking of international travel, of holidays, and so on. Do moves like this help or hinder the pro-vaccine message?
I think, in a way, governments may be using this as a stick in terms of limiting people's freedom to travel. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword. If you introduce some sort of passport system for vaccination, well, that may also indicate the thin edge of the wedge. You may start to introduce other health information which people would rather be kept private. And there is that argument that this might lead to creeping expansion of the amount of information we have to provide to travel. So I'm reluctant to support the passport idea, just because we don't know where this might end up. But I think we need to use every positive means to encourage people to take up the vaccine.
Dr. Bob Gill, thank you, as always. Now, we stay here in the United Kingdom, where we begin with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who joined more than 20 other world leaders in calling for a new global treaty to help the world prepare for any future pandemics. In a joint letter published today in newspapers around the world, the leaders argued that the COVID-19 crisis had posed the greatest challenge for the global community since the late 1940s. In the letter, the leaders expressed hope that any future treaty would provide a more robust international health architecture that provides better protection for future generations. The document was signed by 24 signatories, including the head of the World Health Organization, in addition to leaders from across Europe, Asia, and Africa. The United Nations is urging international donors to pledge up to $10 billion to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria, adding that the need for humanitarian support in the country has never been greater. The appeal comes on the same day as Tuesday's Brussels Conference on Syria, an annual event co-hosted by the UN and the European Union. Ahead of the event, UN aid chief Mark Lowcock stated that plummeting living conditions, economic decline and COVID-19 have resulted in more hunger, malnutrition and disease. Earlier this month, Syria marked its grim 10-year anniversary of the war. The foreign-backed conflict in Syria, which flared up in 2011, has so far claimed the lives of 500,000 people and has left millions more displaced.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert, in Lakesh, we know that Riyadh is very keen to launder its reputation. We heard about sports washing, but this time using the environment in what some are calling a little bit of greenwashing. Tell me more.
Well, this is an interesting story. Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, is pledging that 10 billion trees will be planted in Saudi Arabia in a bid to tackle climate change, and on top of that as well, this factors into the 2030 plan that they put forth, which of course is supposed to gear Saudi Arabia to essentially move away from its dependency upon oil purely. But from the kingdom, what we have seen is that in an attempt to try and distract people, and specifically its critics, they have attempted to, like you said, sports wash and use things like this, now an environmental cause, in order to try and take attention away from the real issues inside of their kingdom. Namely, in this case, if we're talking about climate change, it's interesting that they're currently bombarding Yemen, and the airstrikes have only gone up since the U.S. Biden administration has came into power. That's not going to be good for the environment, yet we're seeing that these pieces are distributed. Even this piece that we pulled up was on the Independent. They're putting it out in, of course, a way which makes Saudi Arabia look good. When people see these headlines, people think that Saudi Arabia is moving towards progress, but that is not what we're seeing with Saudi Arabia. In fact, we're seeing that things like beheadings are on the rise, and of course, its bombardment and genocide, as it's been termed, inside of Yemen is only escalating.
Now, with some of the comments you mentioned there, is that being reflected online, Rob?
Well, the first comment we've got here, and an immediate reaction to this when the story came out, in fact, is from a Twitter user who says, make sure to name the forest Jamal Khashoggi. This guy is a criminal and dictator with innocent blood on his hands. We've got another one here as well who says, how does someone acquire 10 billion trees? More like 10 billion lies.
Right, we'll leave that there. And we move to another story where you touch very briefly upon perhaps the impact of the Biden administration here in not stopping the situation in Yemen. Syria's now come up. What is Mr. Blinken, the new Secretary of State, saying?
Well, the Secretary of State hosted a meeting, a virtual meeting in the United Nations Security Council yesterday, and he sort of emerged as a heroic figure from it, at least if you were to read the Western press, that's how it's being portrayed, as he's calling for the opening of more humanitarian aid corridors and the upping of aid into Syria. You know, it just so happens that the humanitarian king, Antony Blinken, is calling for the aid corridors, which lead directly into northeastern Syria, to be opened most urgently. And that's where the United States just so happens to have a few hundred of its forces, and of course, its allies, the Kurdish SDF, operating and holds the country. And of course, it is the United States, and Antony Blinken was part of this in the Obama administration, that helped start this war, backing al-Qaeda-linked groups. And of course, in this meeting as well, we saw a lot of attention on northwestern Syria, which is controlled by a group, primarily this group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And they are an offshoot, essentially the name has just changed, of Shabat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, essentially. Whilst this was ongoing and we saw a lot of talk about the humanitarian situation in Syria, we saw relatively no talk whatsoever about the sanctions regime, that's the CSAR Act. They said over the past year, the humanitarian situation has grown in extremely dire. It's got a lot worse. But it was last year, in fact, in June, when the CSAR Act was first put into action. And so it's only natural that this has happened in the country, and yet we're not hearing anything. In fact, it was only the Syrian and Russian representatives in the Security Council that even mentioned the sanctions.
Indeed, you wouldn't be at all suggesting that the two things are linked, would you, Robert? I mean, perish the thought. Quick trawl through social media, please.
The first reaction we have here states that the United States waged a decade-long proxy war against Syria, is occupying large swathes of its territory, stealing its oil, wheat supplies, and imposing sanctions so severe millions of Syrians are going hungry. And this piece of garbage has the goal to talk about humanitarian aid. It's depraved. We've got another one here as well, another strong response from Todd, who says, when Syria refused to have the pipeline bisect their nation, the United States organized and funded terrorists and imposed sanctions. Humanitarian aid does not come with strings nor conditions. Humanitarians do not impose complicity with siege warfare.
All right, strong words to leave it on. Robert Inakesh, thank you. Now, pious Muslim women across Europe are finding life more difficult amid growing Islamophobia. Switzerland became the most recent country to ban the niqab on the continent, forcing Muslim women to give up a key aspect of their faith by force. Now, what impact does this state-backed anti-Islam law have on women's lives? Well, Robert Carter followed up the story and filed this report.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you. I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere, the defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve. The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
France's foreign minister has cranked up further pressure on Lebanese leaders to form a working government, urging them in personal phone calls for an immediate halt to what he called deliberate obstruction. Earlier in the week, Jean-Yves Le Drian called Lebanese President Michel Aoun, Acting Prime Minister Saad Hariri, and Parliamentary Speaker Nabi Berri, and called for an end to the 7 months of political deadlock that's driven the country toward collapse. The latest rounds of talks between Aoun and Hariri collapsed last week. Disagreements over the shape and size of a new cabinet continue to block any progress. Lebanon is currently facing its worst economic crisis in modern history, a situation exacerbated by pandemic restrictions and last year's explosion at Beirut's port. It's the event that reignited the Black Lives Matter movement last summer in the U.S. and across the globe. Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who knelt on the body of African-American George Floyd, is finally in the docks with the eyes of the world on his every move, on his every statement. Richard Sudan's been closely following this one online. It's disturbing already, Richard.
And it's disturbing many people around the world who are keeping an eye on proceedings, having seen the event take place in May of last year. Now, there's been massive protests taking place outside the courthouse where proceedings are happening. And on the second day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, we've seen some very emotional and graphic testimony from witnesses that have been called to the stand. Now, we've heard one testimony from one witness named Donald Williams, who talked about the life draining away from George Floyd's eyes, the life visibly draining away from his face as Derek Chauvin knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. And he talked about the fact that George Floyd was quite clearly not resisting arrest. And this witness flatly referred to the actions of Derek Chauvin as murder, which of course chimes and resonates with how most people around the world really saw this event transpire. We saw another witness talk about the fact that viewing the footage of the incident taking place in real time, that Derek Chauvin knelt on the neck of George Floyd for so long that she actually thought the video footage had actually frozen the scenes were that serious. And actually, one of the things which is really catching people's attention and which people are incredulous about is the fact that the defense is arguing that Derek Chauvin used reasonable force and was following police protocol and procedures. Vast, you know, millions of people around the world really don't view it this way, Amina. Derek Chauvin is facing 2 counts of murder, 1 count of manslaughter, and people are already skeptical about whether or not they'll see a conviction. And of course, the actual reality in the United States, I'm afraid for many people, is that even if Derek Chauvin goes to prison, for there to be a real precedent set, which would actually see systemic change in the United States, there are numbers and there are many, many police officers, critics would say, that simply need to be jailed for the killing of black people while they wear police uniforms. I mean, so the whole world is watching this trial, and we've seen very emotional testimonies indeed.
Social media for us. Can you choose your favorite 2 tweets on this topic for me, Richard?
Let's go first to Bishop Talbot Swan, who says, which one of you who are swearing that Derek Chauvin's actions had nothing to do with George Floyd's death are willing to lay handcuffed on the ground and allow a grown man to kneel on your neck with his full weight for 9 minutes to demonstrate how harmless that is? I'll wait. And we have a reaction also from Daniel, who says, if they don't do the right thing in the Derek Chauvin trial, it seems reasonable to expect that major response activities will take place. George Floyd was absolutely intentionally murdered. Floyd mattered and still does, and thousands upon thousands of other victims do too.
All right, we'll move on to another story, controversial for different reasons, Richard.
Indeed. So Ghislaine Maxwell, the confidant, partner, and some would say collaborator with Jeffrey Epstein, is facing sex trafficking charges. Now, of course, Jeffrey Epstein was accused of running perhaps most the wide-reaching and elaborate abuse ring possibly in history, many people are saying. And of course, Ghislaine Maxwell was a key figure in that. Now, she's facing charges. We'll see where this goes. Of course, Epstein actually died in New York Correctional Facility in the summer of 2019. The official reason was, of course, suicide, but many people actually say that he was murdered in order to prevent him testifying and releasing information on a lot of people. And some people would say Prince Andrew is one of the people that potentially would have had the lid lifted on his activities. And so, of course, this trial and these charges are about Ghislaine Maxwell, but really this is about the number of people that were potentially implicated in this abuse ring ran by Jeffrey Epstein. And actually, I mean, some people say that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were Israeli spies. That's what a lot of people online are certainly saying. So, you know, this kind of move is welcome, if you like, but I'm afraid for a lot of people, the fact that Jeffrey Epstein will never take the stand will probably, some might say, mean that many other people potentially implicated in this massive, massive crime will never face full accountability for their actions. Of course, Prince Andrew was famously pictured with Virginia Giuffre, who was allegedly trafficked, with Ghislaine Maxwell literally in the picture. And of course, the famous interview took place with Prince Andrew, where he denied virtually all of the questions that were put to him.
Despite some of that photographic evidence, we have time for just one tweet, Richard.
So let's go to Anthony online, who says, Ghislaine Maxwell, officially charged with sex trafficking of minors. Will Trump send her another message wishing her well in court? And will Prince Andrew's inability to sweat finally be cured? Hashtag Trump.
Wow, it may well be that miracle. Richard Sedan, thank you.
And thank you so much for being with us for this edition of The Bulletin. Please stay there until next time.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. I'm Muhammad, and today I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
ق قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: إن لله في كل نعمة حقا، فمن أداه زاده منها، ومن قصر فيه خاطر بزوال نعمته.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "Surely in every blessing there is a right of Allah. If one discharges that right, Allah increases the blessing. And if one falls short of doing so, one stands in danger of losing the blessing."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons and profound lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali is the fact that we should emphasize and we should focus on eloquence. Now, I'm sure, as many of you know, and I would consider myself in this situation, many of us are not born with eloquence. But eloquence, dear friends, is something that needs to be practiced. It needs to be practiced and continuously worked upon in order for someone to be able to reach some point of eloquence. Now, it is interesting, but in the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and in the early age of Islam, and even prior to that, in what is known as the age of Jahiliyya, the age of ignorance, the Arabs were considered to be well-versed in eloquence. In Arabic, it is known as fasahat and balaghat. But we find that when we reach the Holy Prophet Muhammad and the Holy Quran, this fasaha and this balagha, this eloquence, this precision of language, this accuracy of language, this perfection of being able to put forth and transfer meaning via words was truly perfected and taken to the heights which have never been able to afterwards by the Holy Prophet and by the Holy Quran. Furthermore, we see that the student, the best student, the most perfect student of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam, also took these heights of eloquence to even greater lengths. As for eloquence, of course it can be said that it was founded by Imam Ali alayhi salam, who of course learned it from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, whom of course was given it by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Of course, the peak of eloquence, the book which is the compilation of the letters and the statements and the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam, as is known as Nahj al-Balagha, the peak of eloquence, for Imam Ali had truly reached the zenith and the peak of this technique. It has been rightly said by Sunni and Shia scholars, by Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, that Imam Ali's words are above the words of all creatures and beneath those of the Creator. Non-Muslim scholars such as George Jordak and Henry Corbin have truly attested to the fact that the words of Imam Ali are above the words of creatures, yet beneath the words of Allah. And so we too, dear brothers and sisters, if we want to put forth the message of Islam, you and myself, we must learn and pray to Allah that He puts eloquence upon our tongues, that He puts refinement within our hearts and souls, so that we too, like Imam Ali alayhi salam, can portray the message of Islam in the pure and most perfect manner that which it is. a beautiful and profound lesson indeed brought to us all by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajab Ali.
Imam Ali gives a beautiful sentence. He says, there is so much for me to read here. He says, my son, though the span of my age is not as large as that of some other people who have passed away before me, I look to study their lives. I put myself in their shoes. I went through their activities. I contemplated over their deliberations. I studied their remains, relics and ruins, and I pondered over their lives so deeply that I felt as if I was living it. Meaning I projected forward. He said, my son, project forward. When you look at old people, look at them. One day you will be like them. These are golden advices of a man who was so great an imam, so chosen, so valiant, yet so humble. He says, from the very beginning, I took care to help you to develop a noble character to fit you. Meaning a father is being a good role model to his son. He says, remember, my son, the best of these advices of mine are those which tell you to be aware of Allah, to concentrate and to confine yourself to the performance of these duties. Imam Ali speaks about salah. He says, realize this truth, my son, that the Lord who owns and holds the treasures of the heaven and earth, notice my every sentence I've spoken so far, not a sentence does he call himself as a focal point. This is why we love Imam Ali. All these accusations that we Shia are worshipping or the lovers of Ahlul Bayt are worshipping, this is all false accusation. He says, realize this truth, my son, that the Lord who owns and holds the treasures of the heaven and earth has given you permission to ask and beg for them and has promised to grant your prayers. Ad'uni astajib lakum. He has told you to pray for his favors that you may be granted and to ask for his blessings. Imam basically saying to his son, don't go anywhere. Don't ask anybody for anything. Ask Allah subhanahu
wa ta'ala. He says, ask him, he will grant you your heart's desire. And if he doesn't give it to you, understand that it is good for you. And if he gives it to you, understand it is good for you.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New proposals have been made to expand the capacity of the express rail cargo lines between Chinese plants and European nodes and slash not only time but also cost to lure more goods to flow overland from China to Europe. 2020 data from the Suez Canal's operator shows as much as 80% of the trade between Asia and Europe still flows via the Suez Canal. We've prepared for you an article written by Frank Chen under the heading Suez Canal Logjam Boosts China-Europe Rail Link. The article has been published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Frank Chen's article. Chinese manufacturers, exporters and shipping firms whose vessels and consignments are still stuck in the logjam of the Suez Canal are scrambling to find detours for their wares. This is despite news on Monday, 29th of March, that the Egyptian operator of the waterway has freed the container ship which ran aground and stymied intercontinental trade flow a week ago. The Evergreen, one of the largest ships of its kind, was fully laden after making a port call at China's Shenzhen port, but became wedged whilst passing through the Suez Canal en route to Rotterdam in the Netherlands. Chinese papers cite shipping agencies and forwarding firms as saying that the 20,000-plus containers the ship carried were stacked full of goods ranging from IKEA furniture to medical supplies, including face masks. The past week saw maritime traffic at both ends of the Suez Canal, a vital 163-kilometer shortcut linking the Mediterranean and the Red Seas, back up in both directions. In the meantime, China Railway Group Cargo Division has seen inquiries and orders surge. Space and pallets on the express rail cargo lines between Chinese plants and European nodes are being filled quicker than ever, a new bonanza, as China and Europe just celebrated the line's 10 years in service since March of 2011. New proposals have been made to expand the capacity of the rail link and slash not only time but also costs to lure more goods to flow over land from China to Europe. 2020 data from the Suez Canal's operator shows as much as 80% of the trade between Asia and Europe still flows through the Suez Canal. Rail could wrest the bigger share of the traffic, with trunk lines now connecting China's industrial powerhouses like Zhejiang and Guangdong to Germany's Hamburg and Duisburg, key rail nodes in the heart of Europe where commodities are forwarded to feeder lines across the European continent. Zhang Ming, the chief of the Chinese mission to the European Union, noted when addressing a virtual event marking the 10th anniversary of the transcontinental rail link that 12,400 trips were made to deliver goods from China to 92 cities scattered across 21 European countries in 2020. The Chinese State Council's National Development and Reform Commission also said streamlined customs inspection and clearing procedures and modernization of trains would mean going overland from Shanghai to Hamburg would save a fourth of the time needed for shipping via Egypt's Suez Canal. The State Council and the Foreign Ministry are among the key advocates of rail cargo and reportedly brushed off state-owned shipping firm COSCO's strong opposition to opening more rail routes between Europe and China. Johannes Pflug, a municipal government official in Duisburg in Germany in charge of foreign business affairs, told China News Service that it would normally take just 2 weeks for Chinese exports to arrive in the city of Duisburg by rail, but they would need to spend as long as a month at sea if key waterways and sea lines of communication become congested or blocked. He also said trains going back to China would also be full with auto parts, drinks and food as Germany ramped up its efforts to sell more to its largest trading partner, China. The obvious cost-effectiveness is also attracting Chinese exporters of time-sensitive goods and high-technology products, as the average cost per container sent via rail is a fifth of now curtailed air freight services between China and Europe, with many of the flights grounded by the COVID-19 outbreak yet to be reinstated. The group added that rail operations in China and Europe would work together to feed goods back and forth between Europe and China. Meanwhile, Egypt's Suez Canal is likely to take weeks to ease the gridlock, with shipping firms advised to find other routes to avoid the tailback. China's Central Television revealed recently that the average cost of sending goods by rail to Europe was at least 50% higher than sailing via the Suez Canal, and a capacity bottleneck would push the price even higher. Operator with a port rail transshipment company in eastern China's Zhejiang province, where a majority of goods for Europe were being made, told Asia Times that a cargo train could normally haul 200 containers, but the giant Evergreen ship alone could carry 100 times that amount. He said Zhejiang province's goods sold to Europe via the multiple rail routes amounted to about 1 million containers last year, a fraction of the total shipments made. The Ningbo Zhushan port in Zhejiang province handled more than 28 million containers in 2020. Beijing's new transportation and infrastructure development plan for the next 5 years, recently approved during recent parliamentary session, sets out projects to extend rail lines further into Central Asia. But the plan also envisions new container berths to be built at key maritime hubs, such as the ports of Shanghai, Ningbo, Guangzhou, and Shenzhen. Piggybacking on China's resilient trade ties with the West, Shanghai and Ningbo have been the world's busiest and third busiest container ports for several years.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned. The concept of Ma'ad, or the Day of Resurrection, is accepted by all religions. There is no single religion which does not believe in Ma'ad or the Day of Resurrection. Whoever believes the source of creation also believes in the concept of Ma'ad. As we have in the narrations, we are born to be infinite, to be eternal. From this narration, we understand that death is only a different route for us, and life is continued through death. Here we find the concept of death very useful, because it is through death that we are transferred from this place to another place. In this way, death would be very sweet for us, because it is a new door to the other life. That's why the day and night of death are very much sweet for some people. It is like the day of wedding for them, sweet and pleasant. Such virtuous people look at death not as the final point, but as a starting point for the eternal life. They are happy because they want to go to the other world with the records of their good deeds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasri. Please do log into our website, which is parstoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.